in certain times of life, it just feels impossible to deny that things aren't fair. And in our gospel story this morning, I am afraid to say that it doesn't get any better. And it can piss us off when things aren't fair, can't it? Some people seem to have it easy and others have to work so much for it. But friends, Jesus has a way of turning things upside down and helping us see God, our lives, and our world from a different perspective. So my hope this morning is that we can come out hopeful about things not being fair. Okay? God, we are in your hands. Here we go. I want to tell you a story about the kingdom of God. It's what we're talking about for these weeks. And we're looking at it through the realm of Jesus' parables, the way that Jesus told provocative stories to mess with people. And so if a story or a parable doesn't mess with us in some way, we may need to rethink what we're getting out of it. So we're looking at a story that Jesus told that definitely is mess with worthy. And we're just going to dive right in because I actually want us to have some space on the other side to dialogue afterwards. Okay? So this is from Matthew 20. Jesus has continued to teach. This is one of the latter parables that he gives. Throughout the book of Matthew, he gives many. We'll be hitting some of the ones that came earlier in the coming weeks still. And here's what he says. One day, he's teaching his disciples. And if it's helpful to follow along, great. If it's not helpful, then just listen. For the kingdom of heaven, Jesus said, is like a landowner that went out early in the morning to hire laborers for his vineyard. After agreeing with the laborers for the usual wage, he sent them into his vineyard. When he went out about 9 o'clock, he saw others standing idle in the marketplace. And he said to them, "You also go into the vineyard, and I will pay you whatever is right." So they went. When he went out again at about noon and 3 o'clock, he did the same. And at about 5 o'clock, he went out and found others standing around. And he said to them, "Why are you standing here idle all day?" They said to him, "Because no one has hired us." He said to them, "You also go into the vineyard." When evening came, the owner of the vineyard said to his manager, "Call the laborers and give them their pay, beginning with the last and then going to the first." When those hired at about 5 o'clock came, each of them received the usual daily wage. Now when the first came, they thought they would receive more. But each of them also received the usual daily wage. And when they received it, they grumbled against the landowner, saying, "These last worked only 1 hour, and you have made them equal to us who have borne the burden of the day and the scorching heat." But he replied to one of them, "Friend, I am doing you no wrong. Did you not agree with me for the usual daily wage? Take what belongs to you and go. I choose to give this last the same as I give to you. Am I not allowed to do what I choose with what belongs to me? Or are you envious because I am generous?" So the last will be first, and the first will be last. I chose to use the NRSV version, the New Revised Standard Version, because it's a more literal version than some of the other ones, and I like some of the language that I think is most helpful in that. What a story. What a story. So we've got this guy, and he's working in a vineyard, and he owns a vineyard. He's been careful to take care of it for many years, and the harvest time has come. And the harvest time, depending on how much rain had been coming in or out, was a very particular time that required you to be very careful about how much energy and time you spent getting the harvest. It didn't take long, if the rain was coming, for the grapes to go bad. And you had to wait for just the right time if you wanted to make the very best wine. And so, In the story, we have, there is a vineyard owner, and he goes out and he finds a bunch of workers who are prepared to work for a long day. He talks with them. He says, I'll give you, $10 an hour. You're going to work all day. And they say, sounds good to me. That's workable for both parties. He says, great, get to work. I need you. He continues to go out later and later and later, each time finding more and saying, I'll agree with you for a good wage. Get going. Until the final group at 5 o'clock. So he goes and he invites someone at 6, and then at 9, and then at noon, and then at 3 p.m., and then at 5 p.m., just before 6 o'clock quitting time, he goes out and he finds more people, and he doesn't even talk about a wage with them. He just says, do you have anything to do? And they say, no, we haven't been hired. And he says, go. And so then we go through this story, and we get to the end, and you heard the response when the landowner says, you know what? You know what I'm going to do? He says to his manager, he says, I'm going to fill the envelopes today. Let me just take care of this. I got something in mind. And by the way, when you call the workers, call the last ones who came. Call them first. So he fills the envelope. He gives the 5 o'clock workers the 11th hour. This is where we get the phrase 11th hour from, when you hear about people talking about the 11th, something happening, the 11th hour. These are often known as the 11th hour workers. Gives them an envelope. They look through it. They expect maybe a $10 bill. And they look at it, and they go, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 crisp $20 bills. They look around, because they're sure that there was a mix-up, but they're not exactly going to raise the issue with anybody. Let's be honest. Okay. They gave me the envelope, and so leans over and sees the next guy who was also working with him. Dude, you got it too? We better get out of here quick. And they start to leave, and by then, the next shift is getting their envelopes, and they're finding that they also have 6 crisp $20 bills, and that continues and continues and continues until the workers who have been there working for 12 hours, who were expecting after the first envelope, because they were there, because they were getting paid last, were expecting, let's see, a really big payday. Oh, man, the wages changed, and we are in great shape. And they open it up. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. And they are angry because this is not fair, and an injustice has been done. And so they raise it to the owner. And the owner is confused. What do you mean, unfair? Didn't we agree on something that you said was good all along? What changed? What changed that made what we are doing unfair? Aren't I allowed to do what I want with my money? Fascinating, by the way. Fascinating if you take the rest of the story away and just keep that quote. Because isn't that a quote that we can connect with, that one? Aren't I allowed to do what I want with my money? We really are drawn to that quote. In fact, there's an old story about a man in the 1930s who was known to be very stingy, and he was a business owner and big-time kind of capitalist guy, and he engraved that quote on his building, on the cornerstone of it, "Don't I have the right to do what I want with my money?" And one of the biblical scholars I was reading said, it's just a great practice in missing the point of a context of a passage and of taking a Bible, a scripture and saying, here we go. Because the phrase that follows it is, or are you envious because I am generous? So the last will be first and the first will be last. Okay, I want us to think about a couple things here as we dive in, because this is a really important story about the unfairness of life and how Jesus wants to mess with us and reorient us to a new way of understanding the kingdom. And there's multiple ways to approach it, but I want you to see a couple things before we talk about the various ways that we can approach this situation and how it's relevant to us. The first thing is that I want you to understand that a scholar named Robert Capon, who is an expert on the parables of Jesus, he's written about 4 books, I think, on the parables, and he is really, really good with understanding Hebrew and Jewish culture. And one of the things he says is that the word for friend, I believe it's here. There it is. Yeah. So the word for friend is a decidedly unfriendly word. It's not the typical word we use today. In fact, if you look at it and would nuance it how we might use our English language, it would be more like, hey, Buster, or hey, buddy, come on, pal, chief, hey, pal, I'm doing you no wrong. There is an irritation in the voice that we should take note of here versus the incredibly kind and gracious friend, I'm doing no wrong. That's what they're suggesting that the tone of this story might be. So I want you to take note of that, and I want you to take note of the fact that in a cultural norm, the ones who would work the longest, the day laborers, would always be the ones paid first. Okay? So take note of the fact that there is a potential situation in this story where the day laborers get paid first, get their wage, head home happy. The 9 o'clock workers get paid, head home happy. The noon workers get paid, look at their wages, head home happy. The 3 o'clock workers look, head home happy. And the 5 o'clock workers, woohoo, and they head home happy. There is a way and a story, culturally appropriate and normal, the way things typically would have worked, where everybody goes home happy. But that's not what Jesus is telling. And so everyone listening to the story would have noted, there's something else going on here. Why did he change? Why did the vineyard owner change the order of who gets paid when? Okay. So there are three angles that you can look at this story under, okay? And it's important that we are at least moderately good biblical scholars so that we can understand what's going on and not just turn the scriptures to our own devices in the way that we want. The first angle is the Jewish angle. The Jewish angle, in the book of Matthew, Jesus, it was really written for the Jewish people, and it is a strong, strong message about the Jewish movement and God breaking in and bringing his kingdom to all people, okay? And so the Jewish angle is an important attitude of Jesus talking about the first day laborers being the Jewish people, the ones who had been working and in relationship and in a contract, a covenant with God for generations and generations and generations. And Jesus begins his ministry and starts crossing all of these cultural boundaries, starts speaking with women from Samaria, starts affirming and healing Roman centurions' family members, starts crossing boundaries and talking about a kingdom that is not just worshiping in the temple, but in spirit and in truth that all people can gain access to. And so Jesus is using this story to talk about God's love for Gentiles and inclusion of all people outside of the Jewish faith. Not just inclusion in, yeah, you kind of get to be a part of this, but full-on, complete equality in God's sight. And this is something that would be a real struggle for the Jewish people to hear. So there's the Jewish angle. I find this interesting. This is, yes, Jesus brought a lot of new things, but not completely. Look at the book of Jonah. The book of Jonah is my favorite Old Testament text. In the book of Jonah, Jonah is sent to a people group in Nineveh. They were known as a wicked people. Jonah refuses to go, says, no, I don't want to. We find out later because he's racist. And hates all the people of Nineveh, or at least they have been his enemies, and so he wants nothing good to come of them ever, including the children, including the people who didn't fight against him, everything. He wants it all to burn. And so he runs away because he does not want to be an agent of God's grace and transformation. And so what ends up happening is he tries to run away. He gets, you know, you probably know the story. He gets swallowed by a whale. He gives this prayer, and it's, we're not going to get into it. I taught on it a couple of months ago. Listen to that. And he gets spit out, and God calls him again, a second chance. He finally goes. He reluctantly gives the shortest sermon in the history of the world that I'm sure many of you would appreciate because it was only 5 words long. The whole place repents. Everybody turns around and says, we need to turn from our wicked and violent ways, and maybe God will relent the calamity that's coming our way. And Jonah hears this, and he gets so angry. He gets so angry that they are actually listening to his message. And so he goes up and he sits on a hillside and he sulks because he wants to watch the city burn. And God comes to him and he says, do you have any right to be angry? And he says, yeah, I have every right. I'm angry enough to die. And God says, now remember, God has just saved Jonah in this story. He has just rescued Jonah from calamity. God says, don't I have a right to care for these people? 120,000 of them, some not even knowing their right from their left. And Jonah just sits there at the end of the story. God's always trying to break out into new areas, to conquer division lines, specifically in this story about the Jews and the Gentiles. So there's this story about the Jewish angle. There's also another angle that we can take, and this other angle is often overlooked by many of us who have had good employment most of our lives, and that's the justice angle here. There's a Jewish angle, and there's a justice angle, and the justice angle leans in to the experience of the fifth hour or the 11th hour workers. About 5 o'clock, we're told, the vineyard owner goes out and he finds others standing around. He says, why are you standing here idle all day? And they say, no one has hired us. He knows where to go. He's going into a group of people who are apparently outside of the Home Depot waiting and saying, we're available. And so what we get is we get this story where the owner of the vineyard, for those of us that have had good gainful employment most of our lives, we overlook the identity part of someone who has struggled with finding a job, which some of you have been in that experience, and it is absolutely brutal. Not just brutal because of the financial push, but brutal because our world values people who have jobs more than those that don't, even though some people are desperately trying to get jobs. And so what we see here is we see a kingdom that is like a vineyard owner who goes out and finds people who are lacking purpose, and because of their lacking purpose, they are near the bottom of the social structure, and he says, I'll give you purpose. Come and work. He doesn't even mention a wage. He just says, come. Maybe they assume it. Maybe it's just not told in the story, but maybe they are just so eager to do something productive that they say, come, and we'll trust him. Absolutely. You also go into the vineyard. There's beauty in that part of the story, that God's kingdom values and offers purpose and meaning to the ones that are overlooked and neglected, the ones who feel like no one will hire them. And then there's a final angle. So there's the Jewish angle, there's the justice angle, and there's a final one that I'm just going to call the Jesus angle because it's another J, and that's maybe a helpful mnemonic device for you. But here's the interesting thing in the story, and I don't have this up on the screen, so you're just going to have to listen to me here. In this story, right before the parable of the workers of the vineyard that we've just been looking at, okay? Right before that, Jesus tells a story where he's talking about how difficult it is for rich people to enter the kingdom. And it's the whole, like, it's harder for a rich person to enter than a camel to go through the eye of the needle. And then the disciples freak out because they think that rich people are assumedly blessed by God, and Jesus is debunking that, and they say, well, who then can be saved? And Jesus says, for God, nothing is impossible, and everything like this. And then he talks about giving up, you know, he asked this guy to give up what he was holding on to. And the disciples pipe up, and Peter, who's usually the one who is the big mouth in the group, is really helpful. He gives us a lot of insight because he's got such a big mouth. And he says, well, we've left everything that we have to follow you. So what then will there be for us? And Jesus says, well, hey, calm down, Peter. Don't worry. You will be with me in the kingdom. You will help you. And we don't know if he means these 12 disciples or all the disciples. You will help judge. At the end of the age, you will sit beside me. But what he says right at the end of that is, he says, you know, he kind of calms him down. Don't worry. Anyone that's left houses or brothers or sisters or fathers or mother or fields or children for my sake will receive 100 times as much and will inherit eternal life. But many who are first will be last, and many who are last will be first. You heard that repeated in our story, right? And so Jesus is already setting this, dealing with his disciples who are worried about how much they get out of this because they've been putting in the time. And then Jesus tells this story. And he tells this story, and he ends with this story that quite honestly strikes us as unfair. And then he continues on, and the next story that we encounter just a couple verses later, is James and John's mother says, Jesus, can my children sit at your right and left hand one day in the kingdom? Can they be great? I want them to have the highest status in the kingdom as possible. And Jesus said, nope. No. You're missing the point. You are missing the point about status and stature in the kingdom of God. And then we go on, and the next story is this. Then Jesus says, hey, listen, you need to serve. If you want to understand what God's greatness looks like, it's taking on the nature of a servant. And then he goes, and he meets two blind men, and they say, we want to see. And he says, done. Just like that. And he gives them sight, and they follow him. I love that part. It just says, Jesus stopped, said, what do you want me to do for you? Lord, they answered, we want our sight. Jesus had compassion and touched their eyes. Immediately they received their sight and followed him. And I wonder if that night, after they just began following him, all of a sudden, all they were blind people. They know nothing about Jesus. Jesus heals them and they just start following. I wonder if Jesus had them sit on his right and left at dinner that night. Just as a reminder. Hey, friends. Let's be careful. Let's be careful of what you're actually after. Because the kingdom of God turns things on its head. This Jesus angle is a reminder about grace. It's a reminder that everyone is given the gift of forgiveness and the opportunity for complete inclusion. The Jesus angle actually encompasses the Jewish angle and the justice angle and everything else. Grace is not the sort of thing that you have a lot of or a little of. It's an all or nothing kind of thing. We have assumptions about the way the world works, and it is really hard to shake those assumptions. That's why Jesus told parables. It's to disorient people and knock them off balance. N.T. Wright, theologian, says this, Jesus told all sorts of stories, and each one was like a stick of dynamite, ready to explode at any moment. He went to and fro planting these explosive charges in people's hearts and minds. If we are honest, most of us get the concern when we hear this story, don't we? If we're honest, we're like, I mean, I see where they're coming from. Seems a little unfair. You know you're thinking it. I am. What we have to ask ourselves is why? Why does it strike us as unfair, this story? I think there's only one reason. And that reason is that we assume that we're the day laborers. That's the only reason we find the story unfair. It's that when we read this story, we are the 12-hour workers. We're the ones working at it. Jesus wants to challenge any assumptions in us that would lead in our discipleship to any sort of bitterness, any sort of jealousy, any sort of graceless attitudes, any sort of envy. In discipleship, there is nothing, nothing, nothing positive that comes from seeing ourselves as the 12-hour workers. These assumptions that we make, I think it's the big part of the idea. I think it's the assumptions that the day laborers made when they assumed that they were being treated unfairly. They thought that's what it was about. They didn't think that what it was actually about was the grace and generosity of the vineyard owner. They thought it was about us being treated unfairly. It was a very us-centered approach, and it was based on certain assumptions. And we read this, and we have certain assumptions, and there are a lot of assumptions that we make when we look and think about life being unfair. And I want to dive into three of them briefly. And I think that there are things that we go through life with, either actually speaking or subtly thinking, that become very damaging for us to be able to view God as a good and gracious giver of gifts. The first thing is that we assume others have it easier. Don't we? Don't we frequently assume that when we look at our lives, I often think about, I can really dive into the self-pity. I often think about the fact that because of the nature of my job, I never get to turn my mind off. You know, trying to be available to people regularly, and all of these, like, oh, you know what? Other people, they can just clock in and out. I can't. We all have the temptation to see ourselves as the ones that have the tough route. And we look around and we say, oh, what are you complaining about? This is just a natural assumption that most of us make. Most of us look around the world and we assume that other people have it easier. Man, my kids are so hard. I just have no free time. My family is so complicated. I don't make as much money. If I just made more money, oh my gosh, these people that make money, they have no idea what they have. We just assume when we look around that other people have it easier. Hey friends, everybody's fighting a battle that you know nothing about. Everybody is fighting a battle that you know nothing about. So learn to be kind and gracious and compassionate with the people that you interact with. Learn to celebrate the good that you see emerging in their lives, the gifts of God. We all have battles, and we can't walk around assuming that other people always have it easier. All it will do is add a 12-hour worker attitude in you. You will become a day laborer with how you look at the world, with how you look at other disciples even. It's an unnecessary assumption. The second thing that this often leads to is the thought that God is unfair. And this is just, in my opinion, this is just a result of not great theology. Because we assume that every single thing that happens, God is pulling the strings for, which makes God the author of evil. And I believe that God is only good. And so I believe there's evil in the world, but God's not the source of that. And so when we assume that when we look around and see that maybe someone doesn't have the illness that I have, or someone seems to have an easier way in this area or that, and we just assume, number one, we often go and default to this: God is unfair. I would get what I want. I would have a better life if God cared about me more. Listen, friends, the promises that God makes are not health, wealth, and security. That's never been the promise of Jesus. If you want to look at the promises of Jesus, you'll have trouble in this world. But take heart, I've overcome it. That's so much of a better promise than what we want to assume. The presence of God with us. Jesus saying, here's what the promises of God are. Here's what God's fairness looks like. That every single person in the world has the potential to access full grace, full contentment, full love, the full presence of Jesus, full life forever with God. Hello. That's exciting. If we want to talk about how this looks, how about Paul in the book of Philippians? I love this one. Here's an oft-missed quoted passage. Here we go. I can do all things through Christ who gives me strength. Do you know what he says right before that? He's writing from jail. Paul is rotting in jail, and here's what he says. I'm not saying this because I'm in need, for I have learned to be content with whatever the circumstances. He's writing from jail. I know what it is to be in need. I know what it is to have plenty. I've learned the secret of being content in any and every situation, whether well-fed or hungry, whether living in plenty or in want. I can do everything through Christ who gives me strength. I can do everything through Christ who gives me strength is him saying, I've received a gift that is way better than any freedom from chains could ever be. I've received a gift that brings me more value than any perfect paying job or any perfect family life or anything else. And he says, I've got the secret, friends. And the secret, to give you a Sunday school answer, secret's Jesus. It's the presence and the power of Jesus in one's life. And then the third assumption that we often make, and this one I think is maybe a product of our cultural environment, but that is just that we are the most deserving ones. I work hard for the money, right? We just assume that not only do others have it easier, but we actually work harder than most. We are the most deserving. You know, it's kind of the American enterprising kingdom. I work hard for what I got, and I got this. I struggle for my discipleship. I fight to look like Jesus. That's great and good And yes, the life of following Jesus is a life of self-sacrifice. But to let that lead, to let the sacrificial, the willingness to carry our cross, the willingness to lay our lives down for others, somehow lead to an attitude that says that we're more deserving than other people, that's problematic. We are so deeply schooled in the world of imagined merit. So deeply schooled in this world. But as long as we think that people should get what we think they deserve, we will never understand or perceive the kingdom of heaven. As long as we think that people should get what we think they deserve, we won't get the kingdom. If anyone is treated unfairly in this story, it's not the original workers, it's the vineyard owner. He's the one that's treated unfairly, right? He's the one losing the money and paying cheap laborers exorbitant amounts, right? But here's the deal. It's his money, and he can do with it what he wants. It's his grace, and he can give it out as freely as he wants. And it pleases God to be exceedingly extravagant with grace. What a different attitude we receive when we move from the jealousy and grumbling of the day laborers to see ourselves as the 11th hour workers. Why do we miss this? How do we somehow, even, you realize we're Gentiles, right? Almost everyone in here, I would imagine. So like, first of all, if you look at the Jewish angle, we're Gentiles, so we're the 11th hour workers without any question. If you look at it from the justice angle, many of us have experienced the reality of feeling overlooked and undervalued. Whether it's because of your life situation, your economic status, your marital status, your gender, your orientation, whatever. We've experienced this. And to be loved and known and valued by God is beautiful. Because we've been given purpose. And so many areas of our life, we feel like other people don't value that we have purpose in the world. So we are the 11th hour workers. And of course, in the Jesus angle, we are the ones who are deeply in need of grace and forgiveness. So deeply in need. What would it change if you started to look at yourself as the 11th hour worker? I may have been a follower of Jesus for 20 years. But let me tell you how many days I feel like an 11th hour worker when I lay my head down at night and say, oh God, I missed it today. I tried. I got frustrated. I got overwhelmed. I got tempted. I got angry. I got bored and apathetic. I need your grace. And Jesus says, yep, full restoration. Full restoration. Oh, it's fine. Come on. Full restoration, Jesus says. Yes, I will restore you. We all need to be reminded. And that is why I think the vineyard owner wanted the day laborers present. He wanted them there. We flip the end of the day payment practices. Instead of everyone being happy, Hebrew scholar Kenneth Bailey suggests that the owner wanted all the workers to witness this grace because everyone needed to notice something, and that was that this was not a story about being underpaid. It never was. It was a story about being overpaid. It was always, always a story about being overpaid. And even if we do find ourselves in the role of the all-day workers, the only one who suffers from this anger is ourselves. If we take that tack, can we learn to rejoice with those who rejoice? The grace of God is open for the taking. What if we imagine a different ending to the story? What if we imagine an ending to the story where we see these 11th hour workers opening up and finding those crisp $6 $20 bills, and it goes on down the line, and each one opens with eyes wide, and when the day laborers take a look, they leaf through it, they see that it's 120, what they were agreed to, and they pause for just a moment, and they say, we all got a living wage today. Let's celebrate. Let's celebrate, gang. Let's invite the vineyard over. Let's throw a banquet and let's throw a party. And let's invite the vineyard owner over to be our guest of honor tonight. Because we have enough together. Look at what we have now. What a thing to celebrate. What if that was the story? Instead of a story of ranking and bitterness, what if the story was one of celebrating what God has given to others while acknowledging the goodness that we have received ourselves? What if that was the end of the story? It'd be beautiful. We can do this. We can live with this attitude. Finally, you could say, a story like this, doesn't it make the workers lazy? Right? They know now that they can work for only an hour and hit payday. And the answer is, yeah, it could make them lazy. But not when you fall in love with your work. It doesn't make you lazy if being drawn in at the 11th hour makes you fall in love with your work. See, Israel always had this understanding and relationship with what the vineyard was. The vineyard always represented God's kingdom. In the book of Isaiah, just let this sit with you. Isaiah declares, I will sing for the one I love a song about his vineyard. My loved one had a vineyard on a fertile hillside. He dug it up and cleared it of stones and planted it with the choicest vines. Isaiah gives a vision of Israel with God, loving this beautiful vineyard that God has planted and created, and living in that relationship and wanting and longing to be a part of this. See, that's beautiful, isn't it? To be in the vineyard, if you actually get to know the owner, get to know Jesus, the work is just totally different. It's where you want to be, even when the work is hard, even when the work is backbreaking sometimes. It's where you want to be. It's what you want to do when you wake up in the morning. And you really want others to work the fields and to taste the wine along with you. It's amazing to have real work to do, and it's amazing to experience the generosity of the owner. Amen.